wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Patricia Kullberg, bringing you an hour of interviews and commentary from a radical perspective, the point of view that goes to the roots of the most fundamental issues of our times. We call this show The Old Mole after Karl Marx's image of the revolution, that movement that works underground to expose and undermine the systems of oppression we live among. The revolution is like the mole that pops up unexpectedly in the manicured lawns of a billionaire's home. It is the ongoing work of ordinary people seeking to replace the existing order of society with one that serves us all instead of a wealthy few. The mole often goes unnoticed by the corporate media until revolution occurs. In the 1860s, Louis XIV and his court moved to their resplendent new quarters at Versailles, and the finishing touches were put to the architectural and decorative backdrop of the most magnificent monarchy in Europe's history, encasing in palaces, decor, and gardens the very essence of divine right, absolute monarchy, hierarchy, and authority. And yet, at the same time, the Enlightenment ideas of solidarity, equality, and liberty that a century later would guide the French Revolution to storm the Bastille and establish a people's government were already being articulated and debated. Well, divine right and absolute monarchy are no longer with us, thanks to revolutionary thinkers and activists of the past. But in their place, we now find new forms of dictatorial power and oppression, concentrated among the wealthy elites of corporate capital and the repressive agencies of the state that serves and protects the rights of big capital. To challenge the reckless rule of capital, people's movements have continued to keep democratic ideas and practices alive, and as big capital has turned to the radical quasi-fascist right to defend itself, new movements have sprung up. One of these grew up around the candidacy of Bernie Sanders in 2016, and on today's Old Mole Show, Bill Resnick will be talking with Heather Gautney, a leading activist scholar on what's next in the Sanders Revolution. She is the author of Crashing the Party, From the Bernie Sanders Campaign to a Progressive Movement. If you become a KBOO member or renew your membership today during the show, you can choose to receive a copy of this book as our thanks for your support of this democratically run, community-supported radio station. Also on today's show, our Left and the Law team will be analyzing recent federal laws banning sex workers from the Internet. They will put these laws in the context of larger debates over who controls the Internet. And I'll have a commentary about how the very nature of capital makes it useless to appeal to the conscience of capitalists, for their souls are yoked to something that has no soul, namely the imperative to accumulate capital. So stay tuned for all of this, and if you'd like to hear any of today's show again or recommend it to your friends, our shows are available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, and today's show will be up in a day or two. And now, as promised, here is Bill Resnick to talk with Heather Gautney about what's next in the movement that grew up in support of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Bill.
Heather Gautney, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Heather Gautney, you wrote a book, Crashing the Party, from the Sanders campaign to a progressive movement. Tell us about your relationship to Bernie Sanders. It started quite a while ago.
Yeah, I started working for Bernie back in 2012 through an American Sociological Association fellowship, and I worked in his Senate office as a legislative aide. After that, I went back to my post at Fordham University. I'm a sociologist there, and when he decided to run for president in 2015, I served as a volunteer and worked on policy issues and also did some campaigning in South Carolina on the issue issue of free public higher education. After the primary ended, I was the Vermont representative to the platform committee, and it was around that time that Verso had approached me to write this book. So I started to write the book, thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president, and then, of course, when Trump won, I had to reorient the book pretty much entirely. About 6 months later, I got a call from Warren Gunnels in the budget committee, and he asked me to work as a senior policy advisor to Bernie in the budget committee, which I did just this last year. And about a month ago, I took over as executive director at Art Revolution, which you will recall is a political organization that was inspired by the Bernie campaign.
You wrote the book Crashing the Party, from the Bernie Sanders Campaign to Progressive Movement. You wrote that along the way, wanting to get the book noticed and read, and wanting to support alternative media. Heather Gottney and Verso Press made Crashing the Party available in our membership drive today and as a premium for new or renewing members. Heather, you've really seen it all, the rise of Bernie Sanders. You've seen it up close and personal. You know Bernie. He started as a virtual unknown, except, of course, on the left. He came within a whisper of winning the Democratic Party nomination and then U.S. presidency, and he did it running as a Democratic socialist. How did Bernie do it? Became the most popular politician in the United States. How did that all happen?
Well, I think one of the ways was that Bernie had, through his travels, really back when I was working in the Senate office in 2012, I think he started to realize that there were large numbers of people who identified as Democrat, but who had a progressive orientation, and they were not being represented in the establishment party. And some of them had, you know, a hope that Obama was going to represent progressive values, and obviously he was a big disappointment in that regard. So that was one of the ways, was his outreach to these large numbers of people, these progressives within, you know, who identified with the party. And if you recall, right before, in the months leading up to the primary, some of those progressives were trying to get Elizabeth Warren to run. So that was also an indication that there were large numbers of people who did not support a Clinton nomination. The other thing I think that's really important is that Bernie's been working on this issue of getting money, big money, out of politics for a long time. And after the Citizens United decision and the flood of money into our campaign system, there were large numbers of people in the country were interested, or at least alerted to the fact that the system was being corrupted in a really significant way. So I think that was another aspect of his campaign. You know, he announced very early on, Bernie's never taken money from corporations or from super PACs, you know, or had a super PAC, none of these things. It's obviously now well known that his average campaign donation was $27, and it was a remarkable, historic campaign in that regard. And I think that really resonated with the American public, that here was this guy who came along and was able to raise large amounts of money and expand his reach without being corrupted by corporate money. And of course, that was juxtaposed to Hillary Clinton, who has long ties to Wall Street and Walmart and, you know, every major big money establishment entity that you can imagine.
Also, it seems to me Bernie began concentrating a lot of effort on talking about economic inequality and the way the rich were enriching themselves at the expense of everybody else. And it seems to me that also resonated. He's very eloquent in pointing it out, and sincere, and he had a huge amount of drive, and people loved him.
Yeah, his authenticity is very obvious. Bernie goes to an event, and he doesn't talk for 15 minutes and then, you know, shake hands and smile. He gets up for a solid hour or more, gives a stump speech that's substantive, and says, this is what we're going to do to try to represent the working people of America and buck the control of corporate interests in pretty much every facet of American life. Knowing him personally, having worked for him on and off like I have, he's the real deal. What you see is what you get with Bernie. He doesn't like hobnobbing with celebrities. He doesn't go to fancy restaurants, right? There's he's just a very straightforward, uncorrupted person. And I think that that aspect of his personality was really on display during the primary. And that, of course, resonated with people. The other part of what you were saying about his appeal to economic issues, the financial crisis was not that long ago. Seems like it's in the rearview mirror, but it's really not. Right. It was 2007, 2008, a major crash. And there were so many people hurting from that. So I think that Bernie's message targeting Wall Street, targeting the dynamics in our major institutions like housing, like education, the financialization, basically, of these major institutions and turning them into profit-making entities, that's something that came to a head in 2007, 2008. And Bernie came along and said, you know, Wall Street is profiting off of these institutions that should be public good. And education should be a public good. Everyone deserves the right to a home, healthcare,
and a decent job, and a social safety net.
Right, the list goes on. And the fact that pharmaceutical companies are making a killing off of prescription drugs while senior citizens can't get a hold of the medicines that they need. These are outrages. And I think Bernie really tapped into various ways in which these fundamental institutions in America had been turned into profit-making machines. And he really thought and continues to seek to reverse that and to bring them back into public control.
And he ran as a Democratic socialist, which lots of people thought would be the kiss of death and would ruin him, and advised him against it. I don't want to celebrate Bernie. Bernie is also the product of all those movements that preceded him, like Occupy and the anti-globalization and Black Lives Matter. You talk about that some in the book. Feminist struggles, 15 now. There were so many mobilizations by the left in that period, which sensitized a lot of people. But Bernie was partly a product of the movement, but he was also a sort of magnificent politician. He ran as a Democratic socialist. What do you make of that, and how a lot of the American people supported him?
You know, I think that he did an excellent job of concretizing what that means. And that's something actually that I try to do in chapter two of the book. What falls under this moniker? You know, what does this mean? And in his stump speeches, in pretty much everything he does, he lays out what a democratic socialist platform would entail for everyday people. What kind of education system would that mean? What kind of jobs programs would that involve? How would, you know, the climate crisis be addressed? You know, I thought of democratic socialism in these terms of that he was presenting a holistic, integrated social and political system, that aspects of this system had existed in the United States at different parts in our history and fought for by social movements and especially by workers and poor people. And over time, those benefits and that safety net has worn away through, really, I think, successive losses by movements and, of course, the concentration of wealth and power in elites and corporations.
Heather Gauntney, it's a membership drive here. You and Verso Press, you've given us a lot of copies of Crashing the Party, your book, From the Sanders Campaign to a Progressive Movement. We're going to have to go on to our membership drive and other parts of the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be talking next week about the movements that Bernie and the campaign and you, as the now one of the lead people in our revolution, are building, and with some successes, in fact, over the last months. So thanks a lot for talking to us. We'll also talk about the role of the media in getting the word out and building a left, in acquainting people with Bernie Sanders. That happened on KABU frequently, and also the left press and also the social media. That led to his victory in early primaries, and then he became a national figure. It was actually just a sort of a spectacular and exciting development. Thanks a lot for talking to us. We'll talk again in
Great.
The coming week, and you'll be on next Monday.
Wonderful. Thank you.
The walls are raining down. The revolution starts here. The way you work and the way you play. The way you lay your mother down.
Yes, The Revolution Starts Now by Steve Earle, following Bill Resnick's interview with Heather Gautney about the Bernie Sanders-inspired movement. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO here in Portland. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Stay tuned for my commentary towards the end of the show on why capital has no soul. But next on the show, our Left in the Law team, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, are here to discuss new federal laws that ban sex workers from the Internet and what this means for the control of cyberspace. Jan.
In the spring, President Trump signed the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, FOSTA, a bill to oppose sex trafficking by reducing legal protections for online platforms. FOSTA passed the Senate by an overwhelming majority, and it's been endorsed by the Internet Association, which represents major companies like Facebook and Google. At the same time, civil liberties and sex workers groups have said that this bill makes life much more difficult for many people, including sex workers and their attempts to make their work and contacts with clients or potential clients safer. Well, Mike, sex workers have fought the FBI raids and shutdowns of sites with personal ads, including Backpage, an online paper used by people in the sex industry. They've fought these moves for a long time. What's different about FOSTA than earlier laws and some of these FBI raids in the past?
It makes a fundamental change in the obligations of people who host others. Like Google, for example, allows just about anybody to put anything on YouTube. The reason they're able to do that is because of a law passed in 1996 called the Communications Decency Act, but it had Section 230, a very profound law that said that you were not going to be liable for whatever is put on your website if you're a host. So it removed all fear of liability and led Vimeo and Google and anybody who was a host, or Craigslist for that matter, not to sweat everything, not to have to preemptively review what's going to go on their website.
But the recent discourse on the Internet and hate groups have called that into question, and some would say it's important for companies that own these platforms to be responsible for their content. What would be your response to that?
Well, the reason why that the United States now has all the largest Internet companies in the world is because of that particular provision. I think if we require Google, for example, to check each and everything that's placed on their website, they're going to have to hire fleets of lawyers and end up charging us money.
There's also the issue of not just the cost of it, but what something like that involves. And often, of course, it's not that a fleet of lawyers reviews every single communication. Me writing an email to my mother on Mother's Day, it's selective. And so here we have sex workers who are the selective targets of this broad law.
Well, what happens in practice is that companies like Craigslist simply shut down immediately after the passage of this law their personals. Backpage, of course, stopped existing right away, and several other websites became very fearful of liability, so they too shut down anything that might remotely smack of sex. For example, non-sexual massage therapists are now part of their plaintiffs in a lawsuit trying to stop this law from going into effect.
What about this majority support in the Senate? Because I don't think you find many people stepping up to support sex trafficking. The term itself has a strong affinity with forms of slavery. Sexual slavery is often a term used. So
explained it. That's precisely why everybody supports it. I mean, once you say the phrase sex trafficking, which nobody in their right mind wants to support or further, you've accomplished your goal. The details are where the devil always is found, and what actually happens here is, I think, not even on its own terms going to help stopping sex trafficking. There are many police who say as much.
Can you say more about that? What is meant by true sex traffic and the distinction between that and sex work?
Well, a policeman in Seattle said that it's more difficult because they're able to use sex worker sites and related internet lists to get clues, to figure out what's going on. It's harder for them now to follow tracks, to get initial leads of what might be actual sex trafficking.
You mean the police actually do know the difference, even though the politicians confuse and collapse them. The people who really do this work know the difference between a trafficker and a prostitute who's doing this for a form of living.
Well, there is a really fine lawsuit brought by the Electric Frontier Foundation, which is a mostly libertarian but progressive in many ways group in San Francisco that defends expression on the internet. And they have as a list of plaintiffs, it's they filed it in Washington, D.C.
against this FOSTA bill.
Yeah, they're asking for an injunction to keep it from being placed into effect. I don't know if they're going to get that, but there is a motion to dismiss, and that will be the place where the legal fate of this law is determined. The plaintiffs include the Human Rights Watch, which has long advocated for the decriminalization of sex work, and it knows in many ways how the internet has enabled sex workers to keep lists of bad customers, to de-pimpify, to create a word. It's been very handy, and much of those efforts are been immediately shut down because all the hosts are afraid that they will be civilly liable.
Because I think people may not be aware of how important this has been for sex workers to reduce risk in the context where prostitution is criminalized, that rather than relying on being out in the street to find clients or a pimp, they can assess that there are networks among sex workers where they share information to determine the safety and to be able to have some degree of control over their working conditions, and a lot of networking through these sites that then become closed down. So it's kind of every person for themselves on the streets, where because it's criminalized, face greater risks.
There are sex workers who are plaintiffs. There's also Eric Kozik, a licensed massage therapist here in Portland, a personal massage business, because he's used Craigslist as a chief source for his business, and he's no longer able to do that. So there's several plaintiffs. I think the heart of the case will be the part where it makes the first significant inroad into that Section 230. It's content-based, entirely content-based, and imposes harsh criminal penalties and heavy civil liability for online publishers based strictly on whether their content or views might be seen as promoting or facilitating prostitution or assisting or somehow facilitating sex trafficking, conflating prostitution and sex trafficking, and having it being so broadly and vaguely termed that virtually anything and anybody can be, if the authorities so desire, be swept up.
And many organizations of sex workers, like Red Umbrella, argue for decriminalization rather than legalization. Do you want to say a bit about that? You mentioned decriminalizing.
Well, I think it's a legitimate policy position that people are afraid to express.
Because with legalization, there is, like in Nevada, a lot of regulation and kind of corporate control, and so many, and that may be a discussion topic for another day, but most of these organizations argue for decriminalization rather than legalization. But the criminalizing of sex works clearly allows the government more latitude here.
Well, that discussion itself will be wiped off the books or wiped off the internet by this law.
Yeah. And so that's why, in part, it's important to support places like KBOO. Why do you come down here, my co-left in the law commentator, to do this work on KBOO?
Well, we do the same function that the Electric Frontier Foundation does for the internet, in that they expose what's actually the text of these statutes that have these sweeping and wonderful slogans that lead to their support. What
even among
means.
Progressives, yeah.
And
we show all those devils in the details.
Exactly. That's what we're for.
Thank you very much, Jan and Mike. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and here, as promised, is my commentary. In a capitalist society, capital rules. The need of capital to maximize the return on its investments is preeminent. That need takes precedence, almost always, over every other interest unless blocked by the concerted effort of ordinary people. Capital on its own has absolutely no moral compass. It is inherently and constitutionally blind to every consideration other than profits. It will stop at nothing, no matter how morally odious, in the pursuit of its purely material ends. Slavery, conquest, and genocide, large-scale theft and deception, all these and more are the time-tested methods of capital. The reason for this is not any human moral failing, for capital, to put it bluntly, is not human. It is not subject to moral feelings like empathy and compassion, for it has no soul, any more than a volcano or a tsunami. It is useless to appeal to capital to do the right thing, for it can hear nothing but the ka-ching of money coming in. Let me illustrate with some examples. In spite of Germany's innovations in green energy, which you may have heard discussed here on the Old Mole, 37% of Germany's electricity is powered by coal, and 23% of it by the dirtiest form of coal called lignite or brown coal. According to a recent NPR story, 7 of Germany's brown coal mines are among the top 10 biggest polluters in Europe. And yet, Germany still aims to reduce its carbon emissions to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. End of quote. But although Germany is investing heavily in a transition to clean energy, it is not reducing its carbon footprint. There is a commission charged with the task of phasing out coal, but one of its members, Stefan Kapferer, head of Germany's largest sector lobby, which includes coal companies, says that for an industrial giant like Germany, it could take another 20 years to shut down coal use. The coal plants belong to companies who have ownership rights, he says. So if you're going to insist they shut down, appropriate compensation has to be awarded. And, he adds, we've got to ensure that our chemical, steel, and aluminum industries can access and afford the electricity they need. End of quote. So the economic weight of capital is a major political obstacle to the survival of the atmosphere our lives depend on. Here's another example. In South Africa, the black population is still waiting for the ruling party, the African National Congress, founded by Nelson Mandela, to live up to its original promises of liberation. The ANC's official policy still includes radical economic transformation. Yet according to Michael Smith, writing in the journal Catalyst, the newly installed president, Cyril Ramaphosa, once a man of the left, must allay the fears of local and international capital. Why must he do this? Because a critical mass of the nation's wealth, resources, means of production, money to hire and pay workers and to pay taxes, consists of capital. And capital must profit and grow, and to do so, it must do what it can to prevent anything like radical economic transformation. Another example from the days when the engine of capital accumulation in Western Europe was the brutally enforced involuntary labor of enslaved people captured in Africa. In her book about the slave trade, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route, Saidiya Hartman tells of the horribly brutal murder by a ship captain of 2 enslaved girls during the Atlantic crossing in 1792. The case received wide publicity and caused a moral outrage in England, but the Admiralty Court could be trusted not to convict the captain. Quoting from the book, "Were 2 dead girls more important than the prosperity and commerce of Great Britain? Were the fools and idiots ranting about abolition blind? The fruits and majesty of the empire would be impossible without slavery. Prosperity had a price. There was no getting around it. Death was the cost of the Africa trade. It was certain as the day was long. An iron hand was the only way to manage it." And the judge said as much during the opening of the trial. End of quote. Of course, the enslavement and deaths of millions of Africans in the interests of capital was also justified by racism, the idea that Africans were inferior. This is an idea that capital continues to rely on. In a recent interview about his film, Sorry to Bother You, Boots Riley asks, and I'm paraphrasing some, "Why racist ideas? Why are black folks imagined as savage or insufficiently cultured or angry or lazy? The need for these tropes is to teach that poverty is caused by the impoverished, not by the system we are living in. This system needs poverty. It could not exist without it. If there were full employment, wages would be what workers demand. No one could be fired with nobody to replace them. There's a direct correlation between unemployment going down and wages going up. And when wages go up, the value of stocks, which are capital, goes down. The Wall Street Journal openly worries when the unemployment rate goes down because of the impact on wages and profits. They have to have an army of unemployed workers to make employed workers willing to settle for whatever capital is willing to pay, or as little as possible. How do you get people to accept a system that requires poverty? Well, that's where the racist trope comes in, to convince the white working class that they are not at risk because they are not black, so white people can regard themselves as middle class because they're not in the lower class signified by blackness. End of quote. The evils of capitalism, then, are not produced by the immoral choices of owners, managers, and partisans of capital. Such people have lost their souls to capital, and insofar as they serve capital, they have no moral compass other than the sanctity of private property. Liberals who appeal to the moral consciousness of business and political leaders to put people over profits are sending messages into the void where no one hears them. Moral reasoning is powerless against the imperatives of capital. You might as well ask the lion not to eat the lamb. But we can make a moral argument over the heads of capital to each other, affirming the obligation we have to each other to do our utmost to organize together in the project of challenging and replacing the power of capital with the power of the people united to share equally in the work of building a world that works well for all of us. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, the Old Mole comes to you every Monday at 9 with news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective, working to root down the mountains of capital and start building the world we really want to live in together. You can keep up with the Old Mole's work by liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter, and you can check out our webpage on the KBOO site at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And that's where you can find recordings of past shows and more information about our guests and topics. Today's show should be up in a day or two. Many thanks today to Bill Resnick and his guest, Heather Gautney, for their discussion of the future of the Sanders Movement. To our Left in the Law team, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, for telling us about the SESTA-FOSTA laws and what they mean for control of the Internet. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg.